Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Today is the 19th of December, 2018. And I would say that in some of that headline news at the top of the hour, I would like to put the hashtag pray the news in relationship to the continued U.S. withdrawal of troops from Syria related to the president's announcement that ISIS has been defeated in that particular country. I also think that we need to recognize that the efforts of those who are committed to the caliphate, to an Islamic caliphate, to the, I don't even know if the word creation is right, to the establishment of a global Islamic caliphate are certainly not defeated. They're certainly not done. They're certainly not ending their quest to establish a global caliph and a global caliphate, which is an understanding of Islam that's not just a religion, but a military and political power dominating everyone under something called Sharia law. And so I just think that we just need to be sober when we hear declarations of victory over what are ultimately ideologies, because just because a particular group related to an ideology has been effectively stamped out in one particular part of the world does not mean that those ideas have died. And so when we talk about worldview, when we talk about not only how we see the world, but how we interact with others in the world, it's important to recognize that ideas have consequences. Good ideas have good consequences. Bad ideas have bad consequences. Really bad ideas have really bad consequences. And so when you and I are reading the news, hearing the news, interacting with others about the topics that are in the headlines of the day, I think it's essential that we not only know the mind of Christ on the matters of the day because we have saturated our lives with the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments and because we are in a living relationship with God by the power of His Holy Spirit, but that we are also very sober to the reality that there are forces at work in the world and in the unseen realms that are clearly at odds with, you know, sort of the Jesus agenda, the gospel agenda, the idea that the kingdom of God would be advancing even now in this generation, that we wouldn't just be praying, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, but that we would actually be agents of its advancement. So there you go. That's my pray the news, my hashtag pray the news comment on that news story at the top of the hour related to Syria. Let us certainly be ardently praying for our Christian brothers and sisters in Syria and in the rest of what we would think of as the Nineveh Plain, those portions of the Middle East that are very much the cradle of Christianity, towns, villages, entire communities that have been raised by ISIS, now, you know, folks seeking to move back into those places where the land has really been decimated. And certainly the infrastructure and anything that you might consider resources related to rebuilding are going to have to come from the outside. So in order for folks to be able to move back in and rebuild, they're going to have the assistance of the rest of us in order to do that. So let's just be mindful of that during this, particularly during this Christmas season, as you are thinking about, hey, how might I pass on to others some of the blessings that I've received? How might I really reach out and help someone in another part of the world that literally is not in a position to help themselves? This might be one area where you consider gifting some of your resources. Okay, a really wonderful thing happened yesterday in the U.S. Senate, and I want to share it with you. So the United States Senate passed major criminal justice bill yesterday in an 87-12 vote. So obviously, you know, a bipartisan vote. If you're going to get 87 votes in the Senate right now, which you and I both, you know is pretty much a 50-50 deal in terms of Democrats and Republicans, to get 87 votes on something is a strong majority and a strong bipartisan support. So what was this bill that passed the Senate? It's landmark criminal justice overhaul. It's been in the works for some time. It's called the First Step Act. And it, assuming that it now passes the House, which is certainly our expectation, and then is signed by the president, which he has already committed to do. This is legislation that President Trump has been involved in. The First Step Act would be the most far-reaching overhaul of the federal criminal justice system in decades. Essentially, it would change the sentencing for mandatory minimum sentences, and it would give judges more discretion in determining the kinds of penalties that are levied against offenders. And so it actually takes the individual and their situation and their story into account. Now, let me give you a few statistics, because I think that folks imagine, oh, maybe this applies to my loved one, remembering that, you know, 50% of Americans have a family member who is either currently or formerly incarcerated. So this is a relevant conversation for a lot of folks out there in the culture. And so to whom does this kind of criminal justice reform apply? Well, let's keep in mind, this is federal criminal justice reform. So 2.1 million people in United States jails and prisons today, 2.1 million, that's pretty extraordinary. 181,000 of them are in the federal system. So this First Step Act applies to, would apply to, the 181,000 individuals currently in the federal criminal justice system in federal prisons here in the United States of America. That's the only part of the system that's affected by this legislation. So at the state level or at the county level or in your city, those are other, you know, other additional steps would need to be taken for this kind of reform to be implemented at more and more local levels. Now, this is the extraordinary number that I want us to consider in terms of what the First Step Act will accomplish once it becomes law. It would, if all of the provisions of the act are applied to people currently in the federal prison system, I mean, hold on to your hats here because this is an extraordinary number. 53,000 years will be shaved off of current mandatory sentencing. We're talking about redeeming 53,000 years for people currently incarcerated. Think about that for a moment. We're talking about redeeming 53,000 years of life, of liberty, and of potential positive impact in families and communities. So this is legislation that received endorsements from a wide variety of folks, a wide variety of political advocacy groups, a wide variety of Christian, evangelical, religious groups, lawmakers from across the political spectrum. This is actually a piece of bipartisan legislation that you and I should be interested in. We should want to know about. And we should, you know, in my view, we should thank those who have been on the forefront of making this happen. This is not about reducing the sentences of violent criminals or those involved in major drug trafficking. This is about being sure that the criminal justice system is actually just and actually takes the individual into account. Now, why does it matter? Well, for years, advocates and lawmakers have been working to reform the federal prison system, only to have their efforts fail. And so this is something that the president has been concerned about. There has been a bipartisan Senate coalition. And as I have just mentioned, a coalition of Christian leaders who have recognized that our current system is not redemptive. It's just not redemptive. It's punitive, but it's not redemptive. And as Christians, we actually believe in redemption. Yes, we believe in justice. But we are also people who believe in redemption and the power of transformation. And each and every one of us who are forgiven sinners recognize the value of a second chance. So the bill, as I say, goes back to the House. It's certainly expected to pass there. That the House has actually a less expansive version that they passed earlier this year. And then it will go on to the president's desk. And again, he's already said in advance that he's going to sign it once it gets there. So I just think that When we consider that half of Americans have a family member who has been or is currently incarcerated, then we're talking about, you know, at least half of the people we might run into today who have personal familiarity with the criminal justice system here in the United States of America. And if you have experience with it, you know it needs reforming. But we all need to consider the cost to the individual, to the family, to our society of incarceration, especially when that incarceration is not designed to be redemptive or restorative, but designed simply to be punitive. And so I think that as we consider what our friends at, let's say, Prison Fellowship are engaged in, or others, I know that in our local community, we have some really extraordinary ministries that are engaged in the prison, in the jails and prison system where I live. So I guess I'm hoping that this provokes conversations about criminal justice reform in our local communities and then ultimately in our states. So this is happening at the federal level, and it will affect 181,000 federal prison inmates, but it will not affect the nearly 2 million Americans who are incarcerated in states and municipalities across our land. So let's consider that, and let's consider how it is that we might positively engage to actually have our criminal justice system be just in a way that is redemptive and not simply punitive. Okay, friends, next up, I know that if you're watching the news at all, if you're listening to the news at all, you know that we got all kinds of conversation about the southern border, about the potential of a government shutdown related to the reallocation of funds for use in border security. And so we talk periodically with Matthew Sorens, the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief and the National Coordinator of the Evangelical Immigration Table. He's going to join me next to talk about those issues, but also to talk about something that we should be talking about and many of us missed in the news last week, and that is in relationship to something called public charge. All right, the public charge regulation. All right, I know that doesn't sound too sexy, but trust me, it's going to be interesting. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Next up, Matthew Sorens. Hey, friends, welcome back. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, joined now by Matthew Sorens. He is the National Coordinator for the Evangelical Immigration Table. He is also, let me get the title correct, the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. He visits us periodically here on Connecting Faith to help us understand what's happening with immigration here in the United States and to bring us a Christian perspective, the Christian worldview on those matters. He's tweeting at Matthew Sorens. You can also find him online at worldrelief.org and evangelicalimmigrationtable.com. Matthew, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
It's good to be back.
So let's dispense with the first question, I think, pretty quickly. Prospects of a government shutdown over border wall funding. It sounds like the can is basically going to be kicked to February.
That's what I've read. I mean, I don't think that's happened yet, but that seems to be what most people on Capitol Hill seem to think is most likely, is a continuing resolution. So basically keeping funding levels the same, which would mean, you know, not a bunch of new money for border security or for a wall specifically. And we'll probably be in the same discussion a few months from now, but at least it won't be a right before Christmas thing.
Okay, so you and I, you and I will set that aside, that conversation aside for now, and you and I will have a continuing resolution to pick that back up when we know more. How's that sound?
That sounds
so,
right.
So I would say that, you know, over the last week, this, the particular case of this 7-year-old girl from Guatemala who was separated from her dad in New Mexico and subsequently died in a U.S. hospital, I think that that is a family separation conversation that I recognize is not exactly the same conversation as this public charge regulation. But let's get there from the story related to this family from Guatemala. Because of our policies related to separating people at the border, this father was not with her child when she died.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's a lot of that's still unclear about what happened in this specific case. And I don't want to speculate too much. But I think what's important for us as Christians is that we acknowledge that whatever the circumstances, we want to, you know, protect human life. And whether that family should have been coming to the border or not, you know, we don't know all the circumstances. But we do know that human life, especially a seven-year-old girl's life, is worth valuing and protecting. And it's heartbreaking. I think everyone agrees that with that. You know, what was done wrongly in terms of if it was in there was mistakes made by the Border Patrol or by other entities within the U.S. government, I think, you know, there should be an investigation into that. But it's just heartbreaking. I have a five-year-old girl, and whenever these things happen, I think of my own kids. I think that's what most of us do. And it's just really tragic.
Right. I think that I think that's the right affect. And I think that some of this, when we get so consumed with the policy conversations, we sort of forget that, you know, there's just really precious individuals and precious families involved in these in every single one of these stories and scenarios. And so although, you know, let me just say again to our listeners, Matthew and I are both equally committed to lawful immigration, like, right, we're very interested in that. And so we're not talking here about open borders. What we're talking about is how can we, as Christians in the United States of America, influence the policies and practices of our government to be humane and to bear authentically Christian witness in the conversation related to immigration. And that means that the principles that we want to use in promoting policies, those principles need to be kingdom principles. And so that gets us, Matthew, to this conversation about the issue of public charge regulation. So let's lay a foundation of why it's important for families to remain intact when they immigrate. So let's start there. Let's lay a foundation, a theological foundation here. Why is it important for families to remain intact when they immigrate?
Yeah, I mean, I think on a basic level, this is sort of obvious to not only just to Christians, but almost anyone, but families do best when they're together. And as Christians in particular, we believe that God established the family. In fact, before he established government, he established family. He joined husband and wife together in marriage, and out of that come children. So it should, except in maybe the rarest of cases where there's reason to think a child is at risk or something like that, it should be the policy of our government to keep families together whenever possible. And I think that's sort of a starting point, that if we believe in that primacy of family unity, and I'm talking here in particular, like, you know, husbands and wives, parents and children. Obviously, there's a lot broader questions of, well, what defines a family? Is that your grandparents? Is that your great-grandparents? Is that your third cousins? But especially when we're talking about immediate families, parents and their children, husbands and wives, we should encourage our government to have a bias towards keeping those people together. And that's true when it comes to immigration policy as well. And I think of all the things evangelical Christians disagree on in immigration, that's one where, at least in principle, I hope we would all agree.
So, friends, again, my conversation partner today is Matthew Sorens. We talk with one another periodically. He's the National Coordinator for the Evangelical Immigration Table and the U.S. Director for Church Mobilization for World Relief. Matthew, it occurred to me in reading the post at the evangelicalimmigrationtable.com, .org, which one is it?
.com.
On this particular subject, it's like I felt Albert Mohler talking in the background about the theological principle of subsidiarity. It's like we're supposed to be focusing on the primacy. You use this language, the primacy of family units, that before nations, before government, God establishes the family. And we should be, as Christians, interested in that most basic level, that, that the smallest gathering that God draws together. And so we think about marriage, and then we think about family. And marriage is the institution that God created to be the foundational building block of society. And so, you know, part of this, I think, is our witness as Christians in the larger conversation in the culture, about marriage and whether or not it matters.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's so foundational. And I mean, we have that in creation. We have that in Jesus's words. Jesus says what God has joined together, and specifically he's referring to in marriage, no human being should separate. And I would say that would apply to government as well. I mean, government should not get in the way of husbands and wives living together. And that is an issue with immigration policy sometimes when one spouse is a citizen and one is not. That comes up with issues of deportation, where it's complicated because one spouse could be in violation of law potentially. But this public charge dynamic that you mentioned, it's actually simpler than that than me, because these are people trying to apply for lawful immigration, a citizen filing a petition for their spouse, their husband, their wife, who is not a citizen, or it could apply to minor children or others as well. But basically what we're concerned about is this is going to make it much harder for a U.S. citizen to bring their lawfully married husband or wife to live with them in the United States.
Right. So tell us what this public charge regulation is and how it relates to this conversation that we're having about family units.
Sure. And it's a tricky issue. In part, as you said, it sounds kind of boring. But basically, a little bit of background. Our laws in the United States for more than a century have said you cannot immigrate legally, you cannot get an immigrant visa to come to the United States if you are going to be a public charge. Which is not defined specifically under the law, but the regulations on this, sort of one level down from law, have for many years understood that to mean you cannot be primarily dependent on public benefits. So the way to prove that was not going to be the case for decades now was that if a U.S. citizen was, let's say, filing for his wife, he would have to make a legally binding commitment to financially sustain her. She's not eligible for public benefits for most means-tested public benefits for at least the first several years she's here. And even once she does maybe qualify after many years, until she can naturalize as a citizen, her husband has had to have made a legally binding commitment that he will sustain her more than 125% or 150% of the poverty guidelines. That's how it's been in the past. But there's been a proposal to change that, and we just finished a comment period where the federal government is considering this, where they have basically said, rather than that standard, we're going to give an officer of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, so a government employee, a lot more discretion in guessing whether a potential immigrant applying for a visa through a spouse or another sponsor would ever qualify for public benefits. So it's not enough that they make a legally binding commitment that they won't use them. The officer is being asked to guess if they might ever qualify. And if they do, to take that as one factor to potentially deny their case. So there was one estimate that I think is credible that finds that as many as 200,000 spouse petitions could be denied under this new standard each year. So it's a lot of people. I mean, we've been concerned about 5,000 kids separated from parents at the border last summer, which I appropriately concerned about that. But this could be a much larger number of people affected. And it would particularly be affected in marriage cases where it's often one income earner, which will be a negative factor if you don't have two income earners because this other spouse isn't here yet. Or if one spouse wants to be a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad, that could be a negative factor because, you know, they'll be looking at income in particular.
Wow. All right, Matthew, thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for bringing us up to date on this. Folks can find more information about this at evangelicalimmigrationtable.com. You guys can follow Matthew on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. Sorens is S-O-E-R-E-N-S. Thank you so much for being with us again today on Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Likewise. And a continuing resolution to talk with you again in the new year.
Sounds good.
Okay. Hey, friends, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to make a few comments about some of the fears that I think are in place at the intersection of our orthodoxy and orthopraxy related to immigration. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I want to offer a few, I'll call them commentary thoughts on this conversation that we are having in our culture about immigration. And I really, I'm not going to take a policy position here. I'm simply seeking to get us to think about what we're thinking about. And so if you're already hot under the collar and you're already thinking to yourself, I already know where she's going and I already don't like it. You're actually the person I have in mind for my conversation right now. If you are thinking that everything is working exactly like it's supposed to in immigration here in the United States and around the world, then I don't. I'd be shocked by that, frankly. And so I want us as Christians to be allowing our orthodoxy, right, our theology, to be influencing our orthopraxy, the way we actually live out faith in the reality of life. Okay, so orthopraxy is our practices, right? Social justice. It's the way we live out the faith. And our orthopraxy should be guided by, directed by our orthodoxy, which is right theology, right thinking about the matters of the day. Many of us allow our thoughts and decisions related to immigrants and immigration to be driven by other agendas other than our theology, other than biblical principles, other than kingdom principles, kingdom of God principles. So I want you to ask yourself, like, okay, if I'm an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven, then I ought to be seeking the wisdom of the king here, the king of heaven, the king of all eternity, on the matter of immigration. And as soon as your nationalistic mind rears up in opposition to that, then I want you to take a deep breath and I want you to settle back down and I want you to say, I recognize that I'm a citizen of a nation they call the United States of America, but I'm also and foremost and a priority, a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. And I have a king and I need to know how the king thinks and feels about these people from all of these other nations under heaven and how he feels about my nation. Like, right? We really do want God's perspective on the realities in which we live and in terms of these conversations among the nations of the world. So I want us to sort of get to the fears that I think are operating, at least I see and hear them operating, among folks who in other conversations absolutely espouse to be Christians. And so if you espouse to be a Christian, if you claim to be a Christian, if you claim that you are in an active relationship with God and you are seeking his mind on the matters of the day, then why would you and I, why would people like that, why would Christians fear that economically there's not going to be enough if we let other people in? If we let other people into our country, then there's not going to be enough. There's not going to be enough. That myth of enough, that is not a kingdom principle. And so the kingdom principle answer to the economic fear that there's not going to be enough if we let other people in, the kingdom principle here is, you know, God is actually able to supply all of our needs. God is gracious to provide sufficiently for everyone. The question is, how does God intend to do that today for us and through us? So there are legitimate questions about resources and resource allocation. There is not a question about whether or not, under God's sovereignty, that there is enough. Because there is enough. God is enough. And God is not only the provider, God is the sustainer, and magnificently so, in great abundance, right? There's leftovers after Jesus multiplies the fish. There's leftovers after Jesus changes the water into wine. There's enough. I also think that there's a secondary fear operating, and that's what I'm going to call the fear of the other. As if those who are born in different places or speak different languages or have different colored skin are frankly too different to be considered worthy of being with us. Now, just think about that for a moment. There's this fear of the other because they have come from another culture. They have come from another place. They come from another system or set of values. And so what's the kingdom principle answer to that question? Well, I think the kingdom answer to that question is God is the God of every place. God is the God of every square inch of the earth. There's not one human being that's not created in the image of God. He is the God of his image bearers in every tribe and speaking every tongue. As human beings, we are all equally image bearers of the living God, regardless of where we're born. God actually shows no partiality in relationship to that. We stand on equal footing as created beings, as we stand on equal footing in need of God's saving grace and redemption in Christ, and and in hope of standing together in his kingdom. Like, that's an equal footing situation. I recognize that because people are born in other places, they don't have access to the information of Western civilization and even the shadow of the Christian faith that is operational here in our culture. And so you're right when you say, you know, they're different. They don't share our faith, or they don't share our values, or they don't share our... But that's actually what the Great Commission is all about. And how much easier is it for us to talk with someone whom God brings from halfway around the world to our doorstep than for us to have to put all the resources together for us to go to them halfway around the world from here? Like, the missionary calling of the Great Commission is quite simplified by God bringing the world to us versus having to send us into the world. God is going to have his way. God is going to get his glory. And the Great Commission is going to happen. And if God has to re-engineer or reverse engineer the whole thing because we're failing to go and make disciples, he's going to send those potential disciples to our doorstep in order that we will reach them with the saving love of Jesus Christ and share this redemptive plan of God for all humanity. I think ultimately for most people in our culture, it comes down to a fear of the loss of power. So just think about that for a moment. What do I lose in terms of my power or my influence in the culture if more people from a wide diversity of places come to live here and make this their home? What do I lose when that happens? That loss of power is, I think, really at the basis of our response to immigrants today. And I think as Christians, we just need to be honest about that. And we need to examine our own hearts in relationship to that. What would the kingdom of God principle be to answer the question of the fear of a loss of power? Well, those of you who, you know the scriptures well, you're going to say, you know, God's pretty much uses the weak in the world to shame the strong. God pretty much uses what's powerless to reveal the hearts of those who are in power. God often uses what the world considers foolish to demonstrate his wisdom. In fact, the wisdom of God's not easily reconciled with the way we think about things. Certainly not with the way we think about power from a worldly point of view. I mean, consider here the cross and the power of God demonstrated by the sacrifice of Jesus. Consider the power God demonstrates in an utterly dependent baby named Jesus. How is that kind of power to be manifest today in order that the grace of God might be extended to more and more people living today? Like, I think that when we talk about power and we talk about the loss of power, I think most of us are not wired in to all the power that's available to us in the Holy Spirit, who, again, can multiply the resources that are available and can make those resources extend to more and more people in ways that we probably just have not thought creatively enough about. So those are some of my thoughts about bringing the kingdom principles of God to bear on the conversations that we're having today as a culture related to immigration and whether or not those people should be welcome here. Like, let's just, you know, at some point we got to think about it that way. And we got to say, you know, what is here if it's not a place that God has blessed us to be? And who are we if not the people whom God has called to be a blessing to others? Like, it's a big questions. Not simple answers, I recognize that, but big questions that we need to engage. And we need to engage them not just out of our fear of not having enough or out of our fear of the other or out of our fear of a loss of power, but actually out of the kingdom principles that answer all of those questions. And love to engage with you on this topic. If you want to email me, I am Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can also text me, 877-933-2484. I will let you know that text line gets read by a number of people at Faith Radio. So if you have really hot things to say, the text line might not be the place to do that. Okay, let me share one more headline. Well, you know what? Let's take one more quick break. And then when we come back, I'm going to share one more quick headline, and then we'll make the connecting point. You are listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. So I have a listener who emailed me a prayer request. And I'm going to read it to you so that you can be praying with them and for them in this situation. And you're going to say to yourself, wow, this is how both global and local the family of faith really is. Really is. So this person is currently in Egypt. She is there to attend her son's wedding. The bride-to-be does not have her baptismal certificate. She was baptized here in the U.S. in a church in Pittsburgh that has since closed down. And apparently in Egypt, you can't be married in the church unless you both present your baptismal certificates. So let me be really quick to say, wow, I don't even think most U.S. churches issue baptismal certificates anymore. Mainline churches do, but non-mainline churches don't issue baptismal certificates that I'm aware of. So this is an interesting conversation, right? So she has asked that we would, first of all, give thought. So I have asked her for the name of the church, hoping that maybe I can reach out to somebody and find some help. But obviously, they are very stressed. They had to get 9 stamps from 9 different places to get this civil marriage document, and that has all been completed. But obviously, they're Christians, and they very much want to have a church wedding. So there you go. That's and I'm just going to say that that's a request from Lila, and we're going to be praying with Lila and her family that, you know, God would work it all together for their good. So amen. Lila, we are certainly lifting you and your family up in prayer. Thank you for listening to us on streaming live on myfaithradio.com, which can be heard around the world. And thank you for those of you listening on the Faith Radio app. Always so fun to know that folks are listening outside of what we think of as our terrestrial listening network in our stations on live, you know, radio on the Faith Radio Network. Okay. So I came across an article about this. I'll just describe this as sort of the ongoing progress of laws at the state level related to abortion. And the reason that I'm lifting this up is because this is happening all across the country. And I think most of us are not privy to it. And so in 2016, the state of Indiana passed a law banning abortions that would be on the basis of sex, race, or disability. Now, that is fully aligned with U.S. law. However, it's not aligned with the Planned Parenthood view that everyone should have access to an abortion at any time for any reason. And surprisingly, Planned Parenthood actually advocates that people would be able to get abortions because they don't like that they don't want to have a male baby or a female baby. That should be reason enough. I don't really know how you would discriminate against the race of the child you were going to bear, but apparently that's an issue. And disability, I would say, is the highlighted issue here. You are probably aware that there's an extremely high abortion rate, not only here in the United States, but around the world, but the U.S. is what we have in view here. There's an extremely high abortion rate when children are diagnosed with Down syndrome or other genetic abnormalities through what's known as prenatal genetic testing. And so folks get these prenatal genetic tests, and then they are counseled by their doctors to abort babies who are in any way considered genetically imperfect. Now, for those of you who recognize everybody is imperfect, right? I mean, even if all your genes are exactly like genetic doctors think they're supposed to be, trust me when I tell you, you're a sinner and you fall short of the glory of God. Like, right, we're imperfect, every single one of us. None of us is perfect. We've all got some sort of flaw or blemish somewhere. And so the maybe unsurprisingly, Planned Parenthood has challenging these laws, like this law in Indiana, in federal court. And federal courts have actually ruled that the right to an abortion supersedes the right for states to pass these kinds of laws prohibiting discrimination based on sex, race, or disability. So the state of Indiana has appealed that court decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're now at the stage of the game where organizations like the National Association of Evangelicals, Concerned Women for America, the National Legal Foundation, the Pacific Justice Institute, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church have filed and are filing what are called these amicus briefs, these friend of the court briefs in defense of Indiana's right to pass a law protecting unborn children from discriminatory abortions based on sex, race, or disability. And so I wanted to make you aware of it, and I wanted to just ask, like, do you shudder at the thought? This is my question. Do you shudder at the thought of a child, of a child's life being snuffed out in the womb simply because they have an extra chromosome? If a genetic test can show that that child, something is wrong at the chromosomal level, you support abortion. And if the answer to your question is, you know what, in those cases, I support abortion, I want you to reconsider whether or not you're pro-life. Like, what does that mean? What does that term mean to you if you consider yourself pro-life and yet you have reached the place in your own process of evaluating medical ethics and technology and people's right to raise children who are genetically perfect? What does that even mean? And if they have a right to genetically perfect children, do they have the right to CRISPR technology that would then manipulate the germline in that fetus so that, you know, they could make sure that that child had blue eyes and blonde hair and was prone to advanced musculature or something? I don't know. I kind of made that part up. You see what I'm saying here, right? So there's a connection here between CRISPR technology, which we know has been fully developed in China to the place that there are now two twin girls who are CRISPR babies, whose germline has been genetically altered, which means it is now something they will pass along generation to generation, a genetic trait. And so the CRISPR technology has reached the stage of the game where we can edit in or edit out things we do or do not like, things that we prefer our children to have. You couple that with IVF technology, in vitro fertilization, and you add to that this genetic testing component where we apparently have this list of preferred and non-preferred traits. Abortion is what happens when any embryo does not rise to whatever the momentary version of perfection is in the minds of those who are doing this. And if you haven't thought this much about all of this advanced technology related to reproductive rights in the United States of America, it's time to do so. There is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University whose name is Peter Singer. If you're not familiar with him, please become familiar with him. He makes the argument that ending the lives of unborn children who are diagnosed with Down syndrome is not only justifiable, but also brings greater all-around happiness to individuals and families. Peter Singer happens to argue that there's no reason that live birth needs to be the end of this conversation, because lots of things can happen during the process of birth, resulting in the birth of an imperfect person, and there's no reason in his mind. Now remember, he is teaching bioethics. He's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, one of the elite learning institutions in our country. And he argues that live birth is no reason that there should be no boundary there. Why would that be a boundary in determining whether or not now is the time that parents and doctors can decide whether or not this is a child that should be allowed to live? I'm not kidding. This is where we are in this conversation. So anyone who's ever known a child, or frankly an adult, who's got an intellectual disability or some kind of chromosomal abnormality, we actually know these are individuals with whom we have profound, loving, joy-filled relationships. These are people who contribute much to our families and to the culture of which we are a part. And I think that it's time for the Church of Jesus Christ to step up in defense of life on this front. And so if you are a person inclined to do so, I would encourage you to check out this ongoing conversation about this Indiana case that is rising, hopefully, to the attention of the Supreme Court of the United States related to the use of abortion for sex selection, the use of abortion for selecting out particular disabilities. It's actually kind of mind-boggling that we've reached this stage. Okay, today's connecting point will be a quick one. I want to talk again about words. Thank you for all of you who gave me such good feedback on my conversation about words and sort of being a wordy. So other people are like grammarians. I'm not much of a grammarian. You already know that. But I am kind of a wordy. I love words. I collect words. I love to use them. I like to play them. And so I was trying to make a list of what are words that really kind of emerged onto my radar this year. Now, it's not that these words are new. I will recognize that. I'll admit that in advance. But these are words that I feel like have made their way. They have migrated into the conversational lexicon in 2018 in ways that have kind of surprised me. And we have grown comfortable with these words and their use, evidenced by the fact that they are now used without then needing to be defined in terms of media outlets and politicians. So a politician on Twitter just recently used the term intersectionality without having any sense of the need to define it. Think about that for a moment. First of all, it's a big word. It has a complicated meaning. But it is now so much a part of the cultural lexicon of the day that politicians are using it on Twitter, which is, you know, a place where you can be easily misunderstood without feeling compelled to define it. So intersectionality is one of those words that I believe has really emerged, established itself in the cultural lexicon in 2018. Another one is polyamory. I'm familiar with the term polyamory. I will admit to you that I am surprised that polyamory and polyamorous relationships have so quickly become accepted, and that we have reached the place in cultural conversations where questions are not even really asked anymore. If someone describes themselves as polyamorous or in a polyamorous relationship, which, by the way, just means multiple or many loves, right? This of any variety, any without a lot of boundaries or definition, in fact, none. That is apparently popular, so popular that it's a word that is now common in our cultural lexicon. And you're saying to yourself, that's not a word we use at my church. Well, precisely, and that's part of the point here. The words that we use at church are not growing in their popularity in the cultural lexicon. And so I would like for us as Christians to kind of be focused on words that we want to see reintroduced or re-energized in the cultural conversations of our day. And so I want you to think about what those are. Maybe you want to see the word evangelical reclaimed, redefined, reestablished. Maybe you want to see the word Christian authentically redefined and reestablished in 2019. Maybe there's another word that you've got on your radar. Maybe it's redemption. Whatever it is, I'm going to encourage you to just start using it. Start using it widely. Start using it boldly. Attach a definition to it every time you use it so that people can understand what you're talking about. And maybe they'll begin to adopt it. And by this time next year, we'll be talking about words in the cultural lexicon like truth and justice and mercy. Okay, friends, that's all we got time for today here on Connecting Faith. Always a joy to be with you. Visit us online at myfaithradio.com, the Connecting Faith page. You can also visit my ministry website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.